Roxy, my favorite part of last week's episode was when we talked to our moms.
I know. I started crying. And then my mom started crying.
And I teared up listening. We were all verklempt.
I really do think we should pair up Sharon and Karen for a shopping day.
Agreed. They would have a lot of fun together. They'd be looking for good deals.
So maybe not New York, but also not Kohl's. Somewhere in between.
Are you sure? You don't want a spare 20-pack of tragic undergarments?
I do need socks. All mine have holes in them.
From Religion News Service, this is Saved by the City, a podcast from two single Christian women making our way and making some waves in New York. I'm Caitlin Beatty.
And I'm Roxy Stone.
Roxy, last week you recommended a Broadway show called Pictures from Home. Mm-hmm. This week, I have my own recommendation, but it is decidedly off Broadway.
Oh, no. Did you end up in some comedy show that they were handing out tickets for at Times Square?
You know, it wasn't, although I have occasionally been tempted. Mm-hmm. It was a drag performance of songs from Yentl, which is an 80s movie starring Barbra Streisand. And the performer threw in a bit of Cher for good measure. So between Barbra and Cher, I was pretty overwhelmed in a good way.
Yeah, that sounds like your perfect place. But remind me what Yentl is. I feel like I've heard of it, but I can't come up with the plot.
I hadn't been able to either until I was reading up before the drag Yentl performance. So it's the story of a young Jewish woman in the early 20th century. She's not allowed to study the Torah, but she really wants to. So she cuts her hair. She takes a male name. She pretends to be a man to become a scholar of Talmudic law. Of course, putting aside the fact that I'm not sure Barbra Streisand easily passes as a traditionally masculine man. Yentl falls in love with a man at the school, and a woman falls in love with her, pretending to be a man. So
that is a love triangle.
It's a love triangle.
Yeah, I can't see Babs as a 17-year-old guy for sure. But then I also couldn't see Gwyneth Paltrow as a 13-year-old boy, and she pulled that off in Shakespeare in Love. So
I totally forgot about that. Wow. 13? She was 13?
I don't know. I might be making that up, but I feel like that was they often cast young boys as the females in Shakespeare plays. Yeah.
For sure, Yentl requires some suspension of belief, but the songs are great. And the story got me thinking about women studying God and religious texts for themselves and how controversial that is even today.
Yeah, there's still a lot of stained glass ceilings to break. Later on, we'll hear from two women leaders who have broken plenty of glass ceilings and are eager to help other women do the same.
Have you ever considered going to seminary?
Yes, every 2 to 5 years. I mean, I really hope I get to and do at some point in my life. It's actually like a goal I would really like to.
Why do you want to go? I was very direct. As we established last week, I'm the daughter of a very direct woman. So everything that I say that is brusque is just owing to my mother. But why do you want to go to seminary?
I mean, I think sometimes that changes. I think there... we've talked about this on the podcast before. Like, I really do think that I would love to be a pastor at some point. I don't know that that's what I want to be like as a full-time vocation. I really like my job. I really like doing the kind of work that I've done in journalism. Mm-hmm. And I don't really want to give that up. But I also just see so much value in the vocation of pastor and in the role of pastor in a community and at a church. And I see such value in the role of church in the community. And I think I've always felt a pull toward it in some capacity. So yeah, I definitely would like to go. And there's also just an aspect of like learning that I think I would really enjoy at seminary.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And these are ideas and concepts I feel like I work with and around a lot, as do you. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I'm like, I wish I just knew more and had sort of more of the formal education around it instead of just the self-taught way that I've gone.
Yeah, I very much resonate with that. Not so much the church ministry thing. I think I'm clear in my mind.
That's not for you.
I bless it. I honor that work. I think it's crucially important. Also, it's not for me. But the value of education in and of itself and being in a program mm-hmm. that allows you to dive deeply into texts that I feel like I should know as a person mm-hmm. of religious faith and practice that I'm kind of embarrassed I don't know more about.
Mm-hmm. You know, I have been in a number of churches that ordain women, and yet I have never had a senior pastor that's a woman. And I have only really heard women preach from the pulpit, like as guest preachers or when I've visited somewhere. I too wonder what it would be like to like sit under the authority of and the teaching of a woman, because I've never experienced that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Have you?
I have not sat under the exclusive teaching authority of a woman. Like, I'm in a church now where there are three members of the teaching, preaching rotation, and two of them are women. So it doesn't feel abnormal to me, although I will say, internalized sexism check.
Yeah.
There's still this sense that, yeah, but when Jacob preaches, that's the central preaching event.
Yeah.
And when MJ and Janet preach, it's like supplemental, mm-hmm. even though right. structurally that's not true. So who we assign authority to and how we even perceive authority in interpersonal ways deserves to be interrogated.
There's so much energy spent on why women should be allowed to preach and a lot of energy spent on how do we educate women to do that and get women in there. And I think part of what is an interesting conversation to have is like, how can the church really benefit from having women in leadership, not in a gender essentialism kind of way, like, oh, only women could bring this to the table and only men can bring this to the table.
Mm-hmm. We need more doilies. So I guess we need more women.
Right. Exactly. Like we need more of a nurturing mm-hmm. personality in the pastoral role. So let's bring in some women because only women can be nurturing. Like, I don't mean that, uh-huh. but I mean, like, what do we lose when we don't have women as a whole in pastoral positions, and what do we gain when we do?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I think is a valuable conversation to have. Like, why
yeah.
is this good for the church without trying to be like, oh, just to be fair.
Right. Putting aside the desire to not be gender essentialist, it is the case that gender shapes our lived experience in mm-hmm. the world. Mm-hmm. And so, for example, as a woman coming to a text in scripture that depicts violence against women or Jesus's encounter mm-hmm. with a woman in that particular cultural context, I have a lens. And mm-hmm. I don't just have a lens because I'm a woman. Everybody has a lens. And it seems like
right.
part of what we lose and forget is that these, you know, like white men who have traditionally been in positions of spiritual authority for thousands of years also have a lens that yes. can sometimes prevent them from seeing the full truth and goodness of, you know, a sacred text or mm-hmm. be able to preach in a way that's actually effective to people who have different lenses.
Right. And we've sort of then accepted their lens as the default lens. Like, this is just the normal lens, and any other lens to see this through is like, oh, that's been compromised by cultural context, you know? But theirs has too. I mean, I think of David and Bathsheba and that story as like a prime example mm-hmm. of that. Maybe we don't want to get into that controversy here, but
it's cyclical.
It is cyclical.
It's like the cicadas. Every 17 months it reemerges from the ground.
It reemerges. But I think that was one that really struck me because I never, ever, ever, ever heard as a child that there was a possibility that this was a power dynamic,
mm-hmm.
you know, that there was a level of force in that
right.
relationship. And I always was taught it as a sense that like, oh, this was mutual. This was consensual. Bathsheba was a temptress.
Mm-hmm.
They were both trying to hide this from her husband. I mean, you know, I was always taught it from that lens, which does feel like a male lens in a powerful, privileged male lens.
Right. Right.
And when women could come to the story and say, like, there's like this, she was vulnerable. Like, mm-hmm. there's, it's really hard to say no to someone in that kind of power. Like, these kinds of cultural context, they don't skew the story. They're each part of the story. And it's important mm-hmm. to be able to understand them and to be able to destabilize the notion that the default view of a male in privilege is the authoritative, mm-hmm. correct view of scripture.
Which I think connects to the ways that gender in positions of spiritual authority then shape our actual views of God. And if you only ever hear a man who is presumably like closer to God or closer, better at representing God or Christ mm-hmm. than anybody else, if that's your model, it's not a jump to start thinking of God as male. I mean, this is mm-hmm. like the classic Mary Daly quote, if God is male, then male is God. Mm-hmm. So the importance of having people from a variety of perspectives or social locations kind of quote unquote speaking for God or representing a moral or spiritual authority in a community then complicates correctly our understanding of who God is and like mm-hmm. takes God outside of the white male hierarchy that we've just kind of lived with and accepted for so long and obviously has borne very disastrous consequences in the history of the church.
Yeah. And I think, you know, beyond the theology of it, I think there's just the representation aspect of it too. Like, I would love to have more of my experience being mirrored and spoken about mm-hmm. from a pulpit. Like, as it is now, I almost like every story that I hear from a pulpit about a life is like from a male perspective. So it's about fatherhood, not about motherhood. It's in terms of parenting. It's about many experiences of like living and walking in the world as a man. And I don't get to hear that very often from the pulpit about like a woman's experience in mm-hmm. the world. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's just valuable. That's just good to be able to hear, especially when you have like more women than men in the pews these days. Mm-hmm. So I think it's good to be able to hear teaching that reflects my experience as well.
Yeah. To build on that point, I think about people who are maybe coming to the church with very harsh, authoritarian male understandings of God. Like mm-hmm. God is this parental figure who's out to get you, who's stern, who's like waiting to punish you. What if, I'm just going to say it and you can tell me if it's too gender essentialist. What if for those people having a woman reflect a more nurturing, open, caring representation of God is healing and is something that most men could not provide because they're going to be too connected to these harsh authoritarian understandings of God?
I don't know if it's too gender essentialist or if it's just like that's kind of like how genders have been socialized
right.
in our world. So mm-hmm. it didn't have to be that way, but it is that way often. Bishop Curry talked about this when he was on our podcast. Like he talked about sort of this aggressive, mm-hmm. overly masculine,
like militarized,
militaristic idea mm-hmm. of God. And I think it is mostly men who have brought that to the pulpit.
Yeah, except for the women who think that that's what they have to be like in order to right. get the position of power. But right. I wonder if some of this just comes down to like the witness of Christianity in a world that has kind of rightly assumed that it is just about power or is just about mm-hmm. staking out a kind of grabbing, you know, cultural or financial gain. If having more women in positions of leadership can actually help repair some of the damage that that militarized version of Christianity has done for centuries.
I would like to hope so.
I will say it does seem like a hard sell for a lot of women who do have gifts in who are gifted for leadership.
Deep cut.
Who have these clear leadership gifts and skills. But then I look at the state of so many churches, just the decline in church attendance and Christian affiliation, mm-hmm. incredible burnout among church leaders.
Not great pay.
Yeah, like the cost of a degree, a precarious job market. If women have these leadership skills, is it really worth it for them to channel those skills towards religion, where in at least in some religious contexts, they're going to run up against spiritualized sexism, not just like your everyday business sexism, but like sexism that has to do with who gets to speak for God or who gets to speak about God.
A lot easier to go into the marketplace and a lot more lucrative, or even to go into Christian like parachurch ministry. Mm-hmm. Or like we've done, you know, like go into publishing, or, you know, these areas where you can kind of scratch that itch and be close to it. Like maybe you work for a nonprofit and you're not going to run into the same kind of sexism or the same kind of barriers. You're going to get to do important work that is adjacent to the church or adjacent to ministry. Mm-hmm. And also maybe make a little more money. I mean, I think it's a real hard sell. And it doesn't surprise me that more women don't want to go into ministry.
So basically this has become an ad for recruiting for RNS. Ladies, if you're interested in religion, but don't want to deal with spiritualized sexism, RNS could be a great place for you.
Or Brazos Press.
I wish we were hiring, but we're not. Never mind.
This feels like a good place to transition to our guests, who are doing a lot of work to recruit women into ministry positions.
Today's guests are Lakeisha Walrond and Serene Jones.
Lakeisha is president of New York Theological Seminary, and Serene is president of Union Theological Seminary.
Our conversation with Lakeisha and Serene is coming up just after the break.
Religion News Service is an independent, award-winning source of global reporting on religion, spirituality, culture, and ethics.
Get the dope on the Pope.
And if you like what we're doing at Saved by the City, let us know. Throw us a rating or a review. It goes a long way toward getting the word out about the show.
You can also email us at sbtcpodcast@religionnews.com. We want to hear from you. We haven't gotten any fan mail in a while, and our egos need it.
Indeed.
Today's guests are Lakeisha Walrond, the first woman and first woman of color to serve as president of New York Theological Seminary, and Serene Jones, the first woman to serve as president of Union Seminary. Both women are in New York, and fun fact, Lakeisha was our very first guest on Saved by the City.
We're so excited to have both of you join us today. Welcome, Lakeisha. Welcome, Serene. It's great to have you here. It's great to have you back, Lakeisha. Mm-hmm. Thank you so much.
It's great to be here.
Thank you so much. We are so excited to be with you.
So both of you are glass steeple breakers, if you will. I'm sure you've heard that comparison to the breaking of the glass ceiling many times before. Serene, you're the first woman president of Union Seminary, and Lakeisha, you're the first Black woman president of New York Theological Seminary. So that's really exciting and impressive, and I'm sure provides really important role modeling and also must come with so many pressures. So what are some of the challenges that each of you has faced as women leaders, especially those being the quote-unquote first in your institutions?
So I have been in this position now. I'm getting ready to start my 16th year. And when I was first appointed, when asked, you know, how it felt to be the 17th president of Union Theological Seminary and the first woman, my first response is always, it took way, way, way too long. Mm. Well, we do want to celebrate. I want to celebrate the fact that I'm a woman and I'm the president. It's like, okay, this should have happened 100 years ago, if not 120 years ago. So we're kind of late to the game in all of this. That said, it's extremely important in theological education to have women leaders, because across the board in the United States, the majority of students are women students. The majority of people going into ministry these days are women. Mm-hmm. So to really shift that dynamic, not just in the parish, but all the way up to the top of our seminaries, is crucial. Mm-hmm. And in terms of obstacles, you know, we're at that point in our society where it's no longer acceptable just to come out and say sexist or oppressive things, but you often run through your head the question, would that person have said that that way if I was a man, mm-hmm. if I was a white mm-hmm. man, if I was a black man? How is that person framing what they're saying because I'm a woman? And mm-hmm. last thing I'll say is I think, you know, we're still at the beginning in our society of really breaking through those boundaries, because we still, the major categories we put women in, or we can think of, well, is she like my mother? Or is she like my wife? Or is she mm-hmm. like my daughter? Mm-hmm. And so we have very limited metaphorical roles to put women in. And I'm none of those mm-hmm. things as president. But I can tell immediately what category somebody's putting me into in terms of what they're familiar with in terms of relating to women.
You mean a category other than seminary president, right. which is the category that you serve in.
I am not your mother. I am not your girlfriend. I am not your daughter.
Absolutely. I absolutely agree with everything Serene has said. It is certainly unfortunate, but it is true. And, you know, for me, being the first woman president at NYTS, certainly I'm honored, certainly humbled. I recognize that there are a lot of women before me who were probably just as qualified, if not more, but for whatever reason, weren't allowed to sit in this seat. So I'm thankful that I'm standing on the shoulders of those who have, you know, fought hard so that it could be possible for me to be here. In relation to those challenges, I grew up in a church that did not believe in women preachers and ministers. And so I, for a long time, held on to those beliefs until I encountered a professor at Spelman College who basically said to our class, Women in the Bible, and this is Reverend Dr. Flora Wilson Bridges, and she said, when you have a church that's filled with women and there are no women in leadership, that's called taxation mm-hmm. without representation, right? And so, unfortunately, mm-hmm. we still have a lot of churches and denominations who do not believe in women's leadership, which, of course, then makes it hard for us as seminary presidents even to be able to recruit a certain demographic. Mm-hmm. And so, as we consider those types of challenges, even with what just happened with the Southern Baptist Convention, who mm-hmm. expelled, I believe, five churches recently in the past couple of months mm-hmm. because they had women who were leading us as pastors and associate pastors. It's challenging when you are having to show up in spaces where sometimes you're not even welcomed or appreciated. But I'm so mm-hmm. grateful for NYTS. I'm so grateful for UTS. I'm so grateful for those organizations, those churches and denominations that affirm that, you know, in Christ there is no male or female, and are able to recognize that women and men can lead together and mm-hmm. help make this world a more just world for all of us.
There's a 2016 survey by the Association of Theological Schools that found that male MDiv graduates were still much more likely than female graduates to receive a job offer when they finish. So I would love to hear from both of you in what ways you're preparing women to go into that world where job offers might be scarce, but also, is there something that your partnership or the schools are doing to help find people jobs or to place women in jobs? And maybe Lakeisha, if you could kick us off.
Sure. Absolutely. Unfortunately, this has been a reality for some time now, certainly mm-hmm. throughout my lifespan. But thankfully, we are finding that more women are being called into pastoral leadership more now than ever before. Even as we look at both Serene and I being female leaders in this capacity. So what we recognize is that ministry is not only within the walls of the church, but extends beyond. Mm-hmm. And what we're hoping to do at NYTS is to prepare the next generation of faith and thought leaders to engage in relevant, restorative, and revolutionary ministry. So faith leaders, but also thought leaders. This ranges from those who are coming to seminary to be in a senior leadership position, such as a senior pastor or president of a seminary, as well as those who are starting their own nonprofits or trying to figure out ways to make their businesses more faith and God friendly. So we want to help all of our students, but our, especially our female students, our women students, to understand that ministry extends beyond the church. Mm-hmm. And if we understand that, then we can open ourselves up to even more possibilities in terms of how we minister, how we lead, how we activate our faith in action in our world.
I would add that the situation is, in terms of church placements, is actually getting more acute because the number of churches is declining.
Right.
So there's fewer churches to go around, and some churches who have a policy say, we're not going to hire a woman. But other right. churches may say, well, we're completely open to women, but somehow that guy, when he gets up in the pulpit and preach, he just sounds like a minister.
Yeah.
And that's where the discrimination comes in, because it's like, oh, her voice is just mm-hmm. so high, or he just made me feel more confident. And so that's where you begin to see why it is that men are given preference.
Is there anything that both of your seminaries can do, maybe especially among male students or anybody who's preparing for some kind of position of influence or leadership in church structures, to begin to address some of those unexamined sexist attitudes so that they're not passed on to the next generation of leaders?
I think what Keisha pointed to earlier is really crucial, that with all our students at both schools and together, emphasize that being the pastor of a parish is not the only way to do ministry.
Right.
If they're not going to let you join the team, then just walk right around the team and start your own team. Ministry is wide and broad, and there's many avenues in. Mm-hmm. So that's, I think, a very important approach to take, just to expand a sense of what ministry is.
Yeah, and I think it's also important, and I know we do this at NYTS. It also happens at Union, as I was a former student there, is having conversations about these issues. Because these conversations are not generally happening in church contexts. And so exposing our students even to these challenges, some of our students didn't even know they existed. They just, the male students, hadn't even considered that this was a challenge or a problem until we start talking about it. Mm. And so whether it's in our classroom settings or whether there's a special lecture that happens, we like to bring these challenges to the forefront. Whether it's challenges around women in leadership or whether it's challenges around the LGBTQ community, whatever those challenges are, we want to make sure that our students are thinking about it, that they're talking about it, that they're willing to move the world forward in a way that might be different even from their ministerial context.
Who's worrying about the boys and men in the sense that I heard you mention, you know, like most of the people going into ministry these days are women. And, you know, I think that the data is plentiful that most of the people in pews are women. So is that something that's concerning you? What do you think is driving this sort of gender imbalance when it comes to religious institutions right now? Serene?
Well, I think part of what's happening with the gender imbalance is, and you see this historically, that when the social status of a profession goes mm-hmm. down, then it becomes more open to women. It's like ministry used to have in our nation, you know, it was like right up there with the lawyers and the bankers mm-hmm. as the jobs that you would train and yearn for. And as the church has declined in its social influence as well as its size, so too has its social status. And as mm-hmm. social status declines, fewer and fewer men who are aspiring to a traditional male leadership will find it attractive. So I think that in partially accounts for the gender divide in terms of who's coming. But it's not, I mean, the divide is there. It's not huge. Like at Union, it stays somewhere between 40% and 60%. It's not as if there's no men coming. And we have LGBTQIA and trans students coming as well. So mm-hmm. I do think as a whole culture, though, we need to be, and that includes seminaries need to be, collectively worrying about the state of our boys and men mm-hmm. at a spiritual level. Huh. Are we paying enough attention to their formation and their questions and issues and their hopes and their despairs? So, yes, I think it's a huge question that you just asked as a theological and ministerial issue.
One of the reasons I was so excited to become a part of the NYTS family is because of the Master Professional Studies program that started in 1982, 41 years ago now, that has graduated over 500 men at Sing Sing Correctional Facility. The program has been phenomenal. It has a recidivism rate of less than 10% across the 40 years and less than 1% in the past 10 years. We know that these men, once they are able to acquire this master's degree, they come home and they generally stay home and are able to be more employable, to participate in community building and advocacy and leadership. But my first question as president is, well, we've been doing this for the men for all these years. Why haven't we done this for the women? Right? Exactly. And it's just something that I suppose the men who came before me, maybe they just didn't think about it. I'm not sure. But I'm grateful that this year we'll be graduating our first class of women with our Master Professional Studies program at Bedford Hill Correctional Facility for Women. And so it is opportunities for those who are in leadership, whether male or female, to recognize these gaps and to recognize these inequalities and then have the courage to lead in a way that begins to close the gaps and make inclusive education really inclusive.
This is more of a personal question for both of you. Both of you have either written about or spoken about experiences of trauma in your life. And I think we can safely assume that people who are coming to seminary from all walks of life, as well as people who are then being ministered to beyond seminary, are carrying deep traumas. How does a deep understanding of what trauma is and of the body and embodiment inform the kind of theological education that you hope to provide? And we can start with Lakeisha.
I believe that it would be challenging for any of us to go through life without experiencing some type of trauma. It is really our response to the trauma that dictates how we continue to move forward and live the life that God is calling us to live. I had recently done some research. I believe the doctor's name is Richard Tedeschi, who wrote that we're so familiar with PTS, which is post-traumatic stress, that we negate PTD, which is post-traumatic growth. Often with the stress also comes the growth, which is how we're able to continue to move forward, to engage our trauma in a way that pushes us toward living our best life. And that's the word that we really want to continue to communicate. That after trauma, there is life. That after trauma, there is hope. Mm-hmm. The better we are at dealing with the trauma that we've experienced, whether that is through prayer, that whether that's through therapy, whether that's through conversations with others, the better prepared we are to engage the post-traumatic growth that we all have the potential to experience.
I think in terms of the work of theological education, if we're talking in the context of ministry, future ministers understands that the traumas that they'll need to engage in their congregation are not just the immediate ones we think of with the individual, but also what is the history of this church and what's happened? What happened in the last 50 years or 100 years? How has this church engaged around issues of class and race and gender? What harms are here that need to be faced? And how has this church participated in larger collective traumas, either perpetrating them or suffering from them? Trauma should never be a dead end, but if you don't engage it, it will be a dead end. And it will live inside your body or your community or your family or your society. I think in the U.S., we have so many traumas that we've not addressed, and they just sit there and fester. And so having the courage to even just put them on the table is the very important first step. And then to figure out what does it mean to go forward in health.
Thank you so much for that, both of you. Last question here. What would your pitch be for a theological education for women like Caitlin and me who, you know, we don't necessarily want to become ordained or lead in a formal church role, but are working in businesses and working in publishing and making a podcast?
So this is Lakeisha. I'll jump in. When you think about theological education, we recognize that seminaries and divinity schools were created for the church to prepare pastors to be great leaders and great preachers. As theological education has evolved, it's not solely for pastors anymore. At one time, it was the pastors who were the keepers of the sacred knowledge. But now we have Google, right? We have all sorts of opportunities for folks who, you know, do not study the Bible professionally to gain some theological understanding, right? Google's not going to give it all to you. Mm-hmm. And so we would welcome you to come to a space, a sacred space, where your faith can be affirmed, but your faith can also be challenged, where you will have the opportunity to learn about, you know, how the Bible was formed, to better understand how it can be a source of life and a source of hope. And so theological education is not just for senior pastors.
I'll actually show you how I pitch seminary education by saying, Caitlin, Roxy, you should go to seminary. You are already asking the really big questions. You're asking questions about meaning and about how we live together and what kind of world we're going to build. And you need a theological education to take the work you're doing to the next level, to deepen your knowledge, and the resources there to do that are just at your fingertips. And you can go part-time, you can go full-time, but it will change your life and it will deepen the work you're already doing. So what are you waiting for?
Perfect pitch.
Nice.
Well, thank you both so much. It's been great to chat with both of you.
Thank you both so much.
Thank you all.
Thank you all so much for this opportunity. It is such a blessing to be with you again.
Whether or not either of us goes to seminary to study theology anytime soon, we're indebted to many women who are doing theology in public.
We wanted to give a shout out to a few of them who have enriched our minds and spirits, often at no small cost.
These are in no particular order, by the way. This is not a ranking. This is just, okay. This is a collection. The first woman I think of is Fleming Rutledge, who was one of the first women ordained in the Episcopal Church in the 70s, preached and led at several New York City Episcopal churches throughout the decades, who is a fantastic preacher and writer. I got to meet her in college, and that was like a before and after event in my life. The way that Fleming thinks theologically and rigorously and preaches has been powerful for me and like very important modeling, even if I'm not planning to be in church ministry anytime soon. Who is next in the collection?
Also an Episcopal priest, the OG, Barbara Brown Taylor. I don't really know that she's the OG, but for me, she is.
Your personal OG.
Yeah. I love BBT. I just think, you know, she's one of the most amazing speakers. She was literally named one of the best orators in the U.S. But what I also really love is reading about her time as a priest in a small southern town and just how much she cared about the community and the very everyday like aspects of being a pastor and, you know, just like the little arguments that would break out in the church and the feuds and the, you know, the frustrations of like fixing the roof and just all of these things. But, but like, I love her pastoral heart. Like, she's a beautiful author and, you know, she has continued to do so much great work after leaving the pastorate. I really loved reading about that time and her career.
Mm-hmm. You and E. Karen. E. Karen's a big fan of BBT.
Yes. Yes.
Actually, we got to meet her.
I know. I was there also, and I didn't get to go to dinner with you and your mom and BBT.
She seems like a very lovely, gracious person. We did not have a personal moment, but next on my list is someone who just got her PhD in New Testament, a woman named Laura Robinson. Who
she's so great. I follow her on Twitter and I learned so much from her.
Yes. So I would imagine she's probably around our age, maybe a little bit younger.
Yeah.
And she is really good at taking whatever the controversy du jour on Twitter is and giving some kind of biblical context, like biblical and historical context, like this just happened with the modesty debates and yoga pants. And she did a whole thread about the significance of clothing in first century Palestine and how like contemporary teachings on modesty. She's really good at like picking up on what people are talking about and cutting out a lot of the BS owing to her theological training. So Laura Robinson,
she gets some blowback too.
Yes. Which seems to be a casualty that can occur when you are a woman doing theology in public.
Indeed. The next one that I want to highlight, she's been on the podcast and she's an RNS columnist, Candace Benbow. You know, she grew up in a very different tradition than I grew up in. She grew up in the Black church, and, you know, that is primarily her audience. But I have learned so much from her. You know, she studied theology and is speaking from a womanist perspective often, but also, you know, from a more marginalized community with a perspective on liberation theology. And there's just all of these ways that she has taught me. Some of her columns for us have been like on Beyonce and just some of more like of the moment. Yeah, I've just really learned a lot from her and have and really enjoy her voice and feel like she's got such a like fresh and interesting perspective and really, really challenging for I think the white church and the Black church. Like, I just think she's really bringing a lot of wisdom and conviction.
That's a good plug for our episode with her. I believe it was last season, season 4, on deconstruction. My third and final pick, again, not ranked, just on the list, is also a former Saved by the City guest, Kat Armas, who is a Cuban-American theologian and writer who graduated from Fuller. She is also a Brazos Press author. But, you know, even in just editing her, like serving as her editor, learning a lot about the ways that colonization has shaped how we do theology in so much of the American church. I am a recipient of that because of my social location. And she is bringing a decolonized lens to the way that we read scripture and the Christian story. And I think that's really helped to peel back some unhealthy, unhelpful layers and come to an understanding of God that is more fulsome, that picks up on things that if you're coming from a white Western lens, you might not always see in the Christian story. So yeah, and she's a beautiful writer. And she has a decolonized devotional coming out with Brazos this fall that I'm very excited about.
All right, my last one, because I cannot help myself, is a fiction writer.
What?
Because I think that you can do theology through fiction.
Marilyn Robinson?
Yes, of course. She has written a lot of fiction, but she's also written, you know, other books. Like, as a child, I read books, and that's more of like essay and memoir, and about how her faith developed and about how her theology developed. All of her fiction books just weave in, they truly weave in theology, but not just theology in like a very heady way, but the most like earthy theology, like again, like a pastor in a small town living out the day to day of pastoring this community. And to me, she puts such flesh to the bones of what it means to live this in real life. Almost no other books like really shape my idea of what it would mean to be a pastor. And I just think they're so lovely.
I sense that if you are called to pastoral ministry, it might be at a like a small town rural church, because this has come up with both Barbara Brown Taylor and Marilyn Robinson, like something, I mean, that is truly like a parish model, you know, where you can actually get to know the like 100 people in your community and witness their lives over the decades and be very deeply rooted in a particular place.
I think that's a big part to me. A beautiful thing I see about a pastoral calling is when it happens over decades in the long haul of being with people, which I think is really hard to do and also less and less common. Like, church hopping isn't just for parishioners anymore. It's for pastors too.
The topic for another episode.
Saved by the City is a Religion News Service production. The producer is Jay Woodward, and the consulting editor is Paul O'Donnell. We get production assistance from Julia Windham and Elizabeth Joy Windham.
Chaz Rousseau put together our look, and Martin Fowler wrote our theme music.
We are Roxy Stone
and Caitlin Beatty.
Thanks for listening.